4 more flu-related deaths reported in the state. This hour, a flu update, and you may have noticed that nasty norovirus stomach bug is also making the rounds. Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also today, a new analysis of those diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, how Iowa's medical cannabis oil laws are being put into practice, IPR's Amy Mayer on why China wants to know more about soybeans they're getting from the U.S., and how our bodies react to extreme cold. Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week on this Friday. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk about how the number of children in the U.S. diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder may be significantly higher than previously thought. I'll talk with a University of Iowa professor who authored that analysis about its implications for healthcare policy. But first of all, another healthcare headline. Influenza is spreading in the state. Also, its severity is building in Iowa. 4 new influenza-related deaths announced today by the Iowa Department of Public Health. Joining us now, Dr. Patricia Quinlisk, Iowa Department of Public Health Medical Director. Hello to you, Dr. Quinlisk.
Hello.
Tell us, first of all, about the 4 new deaths that were announced. What can you tell us about the flu-related deaths here?
Well, to be honest, we're very sad to report that in the last week or so, we've had 4 more deaths due to flu reported to us. And to be honest, they're all over the state. So there's not just one place in the state where the flu is bad. It's pretty much everywhere. We just want to remind people that this is a serious illness, but there's some things you can do to reduce your risk.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, though, we do have certain ages. Elderly people are most vulnerable, right?
That's right. The particular strain we're seeing right now can hit anybody of any age, but it hits older people particularly hard. And we also know that older people are just more at risk of getting the flu and getting serious illness with the flu, as their immune systems just don't work as well.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about this year's flu, about its character.
Mm-hmm. Well, this year, the primary strain that we're seeing is a strain called AH3N2, which is a bad strain. This is the one that you hear about, all the people being hospitalized, emergency rooms being overwhelmed, children getting sick and having outbreaks in schools. And unfortunately, you hear about a lot of people being hospitalized and dying. So this is just one of the worst strains of flu that we can see.
Mm-hmm. What about the vaccine that's out this year? Was this strain included? Is it effective from what you can see?
Well, it is included in the vaccine. We can't really tell how effective it's going to be until we get a little bit farther into the flu season. But in years past, this strain of the flu has been in our vaccines. It's been pretty effective, maybe somewhere between maybe 30 to 70% effective at stopping you from getting seriously ill. Wish we had a little bit better flu vaccine than what we've had and what we'll probably have this year, but it's still one of our best tools and still can do a pretty good job at preventing you from getting seriously ill, regardless of your age.
What determines whether a vaccine is more or less effective?
Well, one of the things is they have to start making this vaccine about 3 to 9 months before our flu season, which means they have to sort of guess at which strains are going to be the ones that we're going to see. Usually they do a pretty good job at matching the strain in the vaccine to the strain that we actually end up seeing circulating in our communities, but sometimes it's not quite as good as match as we would like. So that's one of the things. And then the next thing is just how many people in our community get vaccinated. The more people in our community that get vaccinated, the thing what we call herd immunity, the immunity of the whole whole group of people increases, and then that will actually protect us also. So by getting not only yourself vaccinated, but all your kids, and encouraging your coworkers and your friends and family to get vaccinated, we actually prevent a lot of flu from happening in our community.
Mm-hmm. Any worries about a shortage of vaccine? We have enough.
Have not heard anything about any storage or issues around how much we have. So as far as I can tell right now, there should be plenty, both at your healthcare providers, doctor's offices, as well as going down to your local pharmacy or even at your local grocery store. As far as I know, there should be plenty.
Mm-hmm. Remind us of the symptoms of influenza and how we can best prevent it again.
Well, and that's one of the things I get asked often is how can you tell whether you've got the flu or a bad cold? And there's a lot of other viruses going around this time of year that can cause bad colds. The bottom line is usually if you have symptoms only above your neck, so all you've got is a runny nose and maybe a bit of a cough and a sore throat, but otherwise feel pretty good, it's probably a cold or one of these other viruses. But if you have symptoms below your neck, you've got a fever, you've got aches and pains, you're really tired, you lose your appetite, just basically you don't feel good, then it's probably the flu, and that's really your indication that you need to stay home, not only for your own sake and give your body a chance to heal itself, but just so you don't spread it to other people, especially those people who are at high risk of getting seriously ill.
Mm-hmm. When do you need to seek medical attention?
Well, anybody who's at high risk needs to call their healthcare provider quickly if they start having any of these symptoms. And the reason I say that is there are antiviral medications out there that if you start them within about the first day or two of having any symptoms, they can actually pretty significantly reduce your risk of being seriously ill, ending up in the hospital, or even dying. So we really encourage people, if they start having that high fever, cough, feel horrible, runny nose, sore throat, call your healthcare provider. You may need to get put on those antiviral medications to protect yourself and, again, to make sure you don't get seriously ill and will stop you from spreading to those people around you.
Mm-hmm. In the couple minutes we have, Dr. Quinlisk, let's talk quickly about the other illness you do not want to catch, seasonal illness, let's just call it the winter vomiting bug. That's out there, isn't it, the norovirus?
It is that norovirus, and this is the one that not only can spread through schools or long-term cares, but it can actually make cruise ships turn around and go back to port. So this is how bad virus makes you miserable, but also can spread really, really easily from one person to another. And one thing I always like to remind people of, this virus, unlike the influenza virus, does not get stopped by those hand gels. So hand gels are great for things like the flu, but it does not stop norovirus. You actually have to use soap and water to get norovirus off your hands.
Mm-hmm. What is it? It's a tough bug.
It's a very hardy bug. It actually can stay in our environment for a long time. And one of the things when we have school outbreaks or long-term care outbreaks, they have to go in and do special cleaning of all of those surfaces like doorknobs and handrails and stuff because regular cleaning just doesn't get rid of it.
Mm, okay. In terms of health, what other thoughts do you have before we say goodbye for today?
Well, one of the things people are thinking about New Year's resolutions, and I would just encourage people to think about eating more fruits and vegetables and to just think about, you know, getting out of their chair or off their couch and go take a walk. I know it's cold out there, but even if you walk around your house or something, just start moving a little bit. Good things for all of us.
And right, you mentioned getting outdoors, even if it is cold. It's no coincidence that we always have flu outbreaks when we're closed indoors, right?
Well, that's right. The cold weather like this does two things to us. It makes us want to stay inside, which totally understand because I do the same thing. But the other thing it does is it takes a humidity out of the air. And when that happens, our mucous membranes in the back of our nose and our throat actually get dry. That allows these viruses to invade and cause us to get ill much easier. Mm. So the other thing to remember this time of year when it gets so cold is make sure you drink plenty of fluids. Water's best. Just keep your body nice and moist so that mucous membrane can do its job at fighting off and keeping those viruses out of our bodies.
All right. Dr. Patricia Quinlisk, Iowa Department of Public Health Medical Director. Thanks for the update and for the good health tips, Dr. Quinlisk.
Well, thank you, and stay healthy.
All right. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We heard in our news that the Trump administration has freed prosecutors to aggressively enforce federal laws against marijuana in those states that have decriminalized it. Now, we heard in our news also the reactions from those states, both from Democrats and Republicans, was not mellow, to say the least. Of course, here in Iowa, recreational use of marijuana is illegal. But our state has taken steps in recent years to legalize the medical use and now also the manufacture, the sale of cannabis oil for some verified medical conditions. Let's talk about it with Tony Lays. He's Des Moines Register health reporter. Hi again, Tony.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
This news is just a few hours old, but please share your thoughts. Attorney General Jeff Sessions rescinding the Obama-era policy that discouraged federal prosecutors in most cases from bringing charges wherever the marijuana is legal under state laws. That's different. Early days, but what do you think will be the fallout, or what are your questions about it?
Well, it's really hard to tell. I would note that Iowa has one of the most limited medical marijuana programs in the country. And so if the Justice Department was going to try to make an example out of somebody, it feels unlikely that they would start here. You'd think that they'd be more likely to arrest people who are just buying it for recreational uses in places like Colorado or California, rather than come to Iowa and, you know, arrest the parents of some child with epilepsy. Mm-hmm. And make them the test case.
Right.
But hard to tell.
Right. And the oil that's being sold here in Iowa doesn't have or has very low THC, the part of the marijuana that you get high from. But
right.
still, under this federal law, that even that type of oil is illegal according to federal law. Do you know?
Even that's debated. The Federal Drug Enforcement Administration says it is illegal, that it is a marijuana product. The supporters say, no, actually, it's not. It's a hemp product, which is closely related to marijuana, but isn't actually marijuana. So even that is debated. But yes, the feds do say that the CBD oil is an illegal marijuana product under federal law.
Okay, we have a muddy situation get even muddier. Let's talk about our state specifically and the laws that have been passed here when it comes to the selling of cannabis oil. Remind us of what's happening now and where it stands.
Well, so the state had a very limited program where you could get a card allowing you to possess CBD oil, cannabis oil, which has very low THC, but has other properties in it that supporters say helps with things like epilepsy. But it didn't. The Iowa program didn't allow any distribution or sale here, so it wasn't very useful. The legislature last spring voted to expand it to allow production and distribution, and to expand the list of ailments that you could get a card to legally buy and possess it for. But that system is not going to get rolling until 2019, where you could actually go get it.
Mm-hmm. So are there shops in Iowa selling it from when it's manufactured in other states, for example?
There are. There aren't any shops selling it under the program that the legislature passed, but there are shops selling it. They buy it from out-of-state distributors and sell what's called CBD oil. The promoters say it has extremely low levels of THC, and they say it's not marijuana, it's from hemp, and so it's legal. The feds disagree, and the state officials have told me recently that they also disagree, and there have been two incidents in the last couple of weeks in Carroll and Muscatine where police have gone into shops and seized it.
Mm, okay, so these shop owners have a new atmosphere to work with.
They do. Nobody's been charged yet. So it would be interesting if they charged someone, because then you'd have a legal case. And if it, you know, if it went to trial, this could get pretty interesting as far as what the law actually is here.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, we don't have any charges.
List off the current medical conditions under which you can use, according to Iowa's state law, cannabis oil.
They include epilepsy, cancer, multiple sclerosis, AIDS, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's, intractable pain in some cases. Those are the main ones. Mm-hmm. But the distinction is only if you have one of those cards, which only a few hundred people do, and only which you have to get a doctor to certify you have one of these conditions, and only if you get this oil from the authorized system, which isn't actually up and running yet.
Have you spoken with people with some of these conditions and about the relief that cannabis oil has brought?
I have. There are quite a few folks who really believe it has helped them, and the one epilepsy is the one that there's been the most study of, and there definitely is some research showing it can help with seizures and epilepsy. Mm-hmm. There are people who believe it can help with just a huge range of issues, and there are certainly people who take it every day just because they think it's good for them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not a whole lot of scientific research behind that.
Right. I was going to ask you, what do we know about how cannabis oil works in such cases?
You know, hard to tell. I mean, it's like a lot of supplements people take. You know, people believe in them, and maybe they work and maybe they don't, and maybe people feel better because they believe that what they're taking is good for them. You know, that the whole issue with supplements is that there's not a lot of regulation and there's not a lot of proof required.
Okay. In closing, tell us about what you think, in what way medical marijuana will be discussed in the upcoming legislative session starting next week.
My hunch is that they're not going to want to make big changes to the program before it actually gets underway. You know, they took a big step last spring in authorizing what they authorized. They might make some adjustments to it, including allowing the health department to collect and use some fees to pay for setting it up, which right now they really don't have that ability very well. But other than that, I'd be surprised if they add a whole bunch of conditions or if they allow the THC level to go up or anything like that this year.
All right, whatever they discuss will be with one eye toward our nation's capital and the Justice Department.
Sure.
There, right?
Sure.
All right. Tony Lays, Des Moines Register Health Reporter. Thanks for the update, Tony. Always good to talk with you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Ben.
It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's talk some ag news with Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Hi, Amy.
Hi there, Ben.
Let's talk about a couple things you reported on this week. China, the largest importer of U.S. soybeans as of this week, China wants more information on incoming containers of soybeans. What's that about?
It's an interesting situation. There is a new, I guess you could call it a requirement. Some say it's just a request where China wants to know when a shipment of beans has between 1% and 2% of what's called foreign material. China usually buys what are graded as number two soybeans. So, you know, USDA has its grading systems for different foods. It also has them for commodities. There are number one beans, which are sort of the better quality, and then there's number two beans. For number two beans, you can have up to 2% foreign material. That might be grass or twigs or dirt or rocks or mm-hmm. weed seeds. And China now wants to know if the number is between 1% and 2%, which would still fall within the contract requirements, but they just want to be notified.
Hmm. Did anything set this off? What's behind it? I mean, did we send them more dirt and weed and weed and seeds than usual or something?
What apparently they have noticed is a couple of things. When they're getting this shipments that have under 2% weed seed, they have noticed, under 2% foreign material, they have noticed a greater percent of that foreign material is weed seeds versus those other things I talked about. So mm-hmm. that's part of the concern. Why would this concern them so much? China has identified certain weeds as quarantine. It's a little unclear exactly which seeds or whether that information is public and why China is so concerned about it. But one of the people I talked to suggested that they may be trying to keep out weed seeds from herbicide-resistant weeds. There's a big problem in this country with weeds that can survive applications of certain herbicides. China may be trying to prevent that problem from developing through the accidental importation of weed seeds.
Hmm. How has the USDA reacted, and what are the implications for soybean farmers?
The USDA has reacted with a fact sheet and some very jargony language around a systems approach to this. Essentially, what will happen now is when the shipments are monitored and when that percentage of foreign material is identified, if it is between 1% and 2%, I should say, up to 1% would qualify the beans as number one beans. Those cost more than number two beans. Between 1% and 2%, they're number two beans, and that's what China wants because they're cheaper. So now there will be a label that just indicates the shipment had between 1% and 2%.
Mm, okay.
Some of the more cynical observers are saying this isn't about keeping out any particular weed. This is about China trying to force a better quality soybean shipment without paying more for the better quality.
Let's talk quickly before we have to take a break here about this deadline looming for farmers. Farmers have just a few weeks remaining to return the questionnaire. This is once every 5 years, a census of agriculture.
That's right. It's the 2017 Census of Agriculture. All farmers, ranchers, farmland owners should have received it in the mail, and they need to return it either online or on paper by February 5th.
Mm-hmm. Why is this survey important?
Well, if you think about the every 10-year survey that tries to count all people in the country, it's a similar endeavor. And what it does is provide to the Agriculture Department and the public a snapshot of what's happening on America's farmland. Everything from how many people operate a farm to how many acres to what's being grown, how acres are being treated with chemicals, how many old barns there are in the country.
Really? All right. I see a lot driving down the road in various states. But what are some key questions? I think you have a questionnaire with you. What are some key questions that you think are significant that popped out?
Well, certainly the demographic information is really important. It tells us the average age of farmers. It tells us race, gender, veteran status, and whether a person who is considered an operator is also considered retired. This stuff is important when you think about the future of land transfer as older farmers retire or sell land, what happens with the next generation. And we did see from the 2012 Census of Ag that the average age of farmers was creeping up there. Mm-hmm. So where are we at with age? Also gender. There are many more women who are counting themselves as farm operators than in the past, and that's an interesting shift, not so much in who's doing what, but in how people are counting the contributions. But it also asks about what kind of machinery do you have? How old are your tractors and combines? The age of equipment is one of the things that helps when economists are looking at how are farmers spending their money. When mm-hmm. the economy is down, they tend not to buy brand new equipment. When the economy is great, although the biggest farmers have brand new combines, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You said it needed to be submitted by farmers, this questionnaire, Census of Agriculture, by February. What happens if farmers don't comply?
Well, it does come with a big stamp on the outside of the envelope that says their response is required by law, which is true of the regular census as well. Everyone is required to submit it. You know, it's not a law enforcement situation. No farmer is going to have a sheriff's deputy showing up with a rifle saying, you know, give me your response because it hasn't been received yet. But the USDA really relies on as many responses as possible so they can make educated statistical extrapolations from the information. So the hope is that if a farmer doesn't return it on time, then if USDA follows up with a phone call or an email or both or even possibly a visit from a local USDA employee, hopefully they can shake that response loose from the farmer because they want farmers to understand that this is about helping them. This is about improving farm programs. It's about understanding better what's happening in rural America. And so farmers should feel that it's in their best interest to cooperate.
Okay, very good. Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. We'll look forward to your reporting on some farm bill stories, I understand, in the future. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up on this News Buzz edition after a short break, we'll hear about how the number of children in the U.S. diagnosed with what is called autism spectrum disorder may be significantly higher than previously thought. I'll talk with a University of Iowa professor who authored this analysis, and we'll talk about the implications there. Also, we've had such a bout of cold weather. We'll talk to a human physiologist about how our bodies, how our skin, how our lungs, how our bodies react to this extreme cold. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay bundled up. I'll be right back.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Glad to have you with us midstream on this Friday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Coming up on Monday, you'll want to join us. We know the Iowa lawmakers kicking off their 2018 session next week. Republicans remaining in control. Monday on the program, my guests, I'll be co-hosting with IPR's State House correspondent Joyce Russell. We'll talk with Republican Representative Zach Nunn and Democratic Senator Pam Yoakum about the legislative agendas for both major parties. That's Monday on this program. Continuing with our Friday News Buzz edition, the number of children in the U.S. diagnosed with what is called autism spectrum disorder, goes by the acronym ASD, may be significantly higher than previously thought. That's according to a new analysis just published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Let's talk to the man who authored that analysis and talk a little bit about its implications. Dr. Wei Bao is assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Iowa. Dr. Bao, welcome back to our program.
Hi.
Let's remind ourselves that autism spectrum disorder, this is the name for a group of developmental disorders. It includes a wide range or spectrum of symptoms, levels of disability. People with this disability often have difficulty communicating, interacting with others. Tell us what you did for this analysis.
Okay. So we use a national representative data from CDC. So the data set is based on National Health Interview Survey. And we found that the current prevalence, or we can say the current rate frequency of ASD among U.S. children and adolescents aged from 3 to 70 years is about 2 to 4%, which corresponding to 1 in 41 children.
Mm-hmm. And how does that differ than what was previously thought?
Most recent report on autism that is very famous is from ADDM, which is also from another study conducted by CDC. The rate of that shows the rate of autism increase from 0.67 in early 2000 mm-hmm. to around 1.47 in 2010. But after that, in the next 2 years, in 2012, they observed almost the same rate. So there was a lot of discussion about whether autism prevalence has already plateaued or not. So we want to figure out what is the most recent prevalence of autism in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is the explanation here? Is part of it that we're measuring it, finding more autism on this broad spectrum than we did before, or actually that we have more children with autism spectrum disorder? Tell us what you think is going on or what could possibly be going on.
Yeah, there could be many reasons for the difference of the numbers. It is possible that some of the difference are because of the change in diagnostic criteria, and also possibly because of increased awareness of the parents, and also possibly because of the referral system. So it is possible. It is also possible because some interaction between genetic risk factors and environment risk factors in contributing to the development of autism. And this is something we really want to figure out. And if you specifically want to compare the number from ADDM and our analysis, it may be a good idea to directly compare, because these two studies, although both of them are conducted by CDC, but they use different methods. So they have different study designs. So in my study, I don't want to directly compare these two numbers. But just keep in mind for the public that we want to focus on what is the current status of this right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Dr. Bao, it seems we've lost you. Are you there? We have lost Dr. Wei Bao talking about, hopefully get him back, if not on this program, another program to talk about his analysis showing that the number of children in the U.S. diagnosed with what's called autism spectrum disorder may be significantly higher than previously thought. And that's according to new analysis he authored, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. If autism has somehow touched you or your family and you'd like to find out more, check out the latest edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association. I think we'll talk now. Kevin Craigle should be with us here in just a moment. I want to talk about, considering all this cold weather, how cold weather. Okay, we're back with Dr. Wei Bao. Sorry about that, Dr. Bao.
Uh-huh.
Tell us, before we have to say goodbye, what are the implications of your analysis for our health study?
So the main message from this is we have much more children than we thought who have autism right now. So it is likely that we need more resource and personnel who can provide sufficient care for these children.
So we don't have enough, you're saying we as it is, we don't have enough capacity in our healthcare system to treat all those children with autism spectrum disorder.
That is speculation based on our analysis from these. And we found that the numbers of the children who suffer from autism could be much higher than we previously thought. And because we know the current resource are probably prepared for autism prevalence based on previous thoughts. So it is likely there is a shortage, but we need more evidence to prove this speculation.
Mm-hmm. Remind us again about some of the interesting facets of this disorder. It is, I think in this analysis too, you confirm earlier findings about the gender, the racial, and the ethnic disparity of autism in U.S. children. Mm-hmm. Who is likely to have it more than others?
Boys are more likely to have it than girls. This has been very consistent from previous studies. And across different studies, the ratio of boys versus girls is about 3 to 1 ratio.
Mm.
So this is very consistent. And there has been some studies about the reasons, underlying reasons. It could be due to genetic or hormone difference between boys and girls, but unfortunately, the detailed reason has not been discovered.
Mm-hmm. And do we know, is there an environmental component past the genetic reasons that are being researched?
Yeah, this is a great point. I think so far, research on this are still ongoing. We don't have any concrete conclusion on which factors could be the leading factor for these.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Wei Bao, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Iowa. We appreciate your time, Doctor.
Thanks.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we know dangerously cold temperatures have been present throughout the Midwest, across the whole U.S. And we go down to the South and they've had, snow on palm trees in Florida, did I see the other day in the news. And dangerously cold temperatures have been blamed for several deaths across the country, including possibly here in Iowa. Iowa City Police suspect dangerously cold weather played a part in the death of a man whose body was found Tuesday of this week in Iowa City. Joining me now to talk about how our bodies react to extreme cold, Kevin Craigle, professor of human physiology at the University of Iowa. Kevin, welcome back to our program.
Hi, Ben. Thank you.
So tell us, we go out into this sub-zero weather. What happens to, let's say, our skin? We sense that, and what do our bodies make of it and do?
So there's a pretty simple, straightforward reflex response when we're exposed to cold ambient conditions, and the vasculature of the skin, the blood vessels of the skin, vasoconstrict. They shut down. And that's a pretty rapid response, and the reason is to try to essentially create a layer of insulation on the skin surface. We don't want that warm blood that is in the body core, the central cavity, to be exposed to the cold condition. So we have a huge temperature gradient between, say, 0 degree air temperature versus our skin temperature, which may be 75 or 80. So if we can reduce the warm blood going to the skin, we're going to effectively create a layer of insulation that's going to really retard that heat from being dissipated. So it's really a defense mechanism to try to maintain our body core temperature.
So if we could zoom in on a small patch of our skin, we would see what happening or what would be happening there. We see blood pulling away?
We would see, it would be envision a pipe system, and we would close a valve. So the deep arteries and veins, say in our arm, that are going to be perfusing, the arteries that are perfusing the fingertips, we will see reductions in blood flow to the fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And the body will try to maintain that blood more deeply in the tissue, keep that blood warm as it returns back to the heart.
Okay.
So
tell us about the respiratory system. What happens to when we breathe, to our lungs, our nose?
Well, there is that misconception that there's a danger in breathing really cold air in terms of impact on the respiratory passages, and that's really not the case. There's no real special danger, especially in healthy individuals. However,
it hurts. It hurts.
It hurts. And certainly individuals who are predisposed to certain conditions, chronic lung disease, for example, it can be much more problematic. But what's going on is that the tube system that takes in air from our nose and our mouth into our lungs is lined with moisture, and cold air is extremely dry. So as we breathe in that cold air, the body is trying to warm it and humidify it before it gets to the lungs. And so those first couple breaths you take, especially if you're exerting yourself,
mm-hmm.
that burn, that's taking in that cold air, pulling moisture away from the air passages, and humidifying it before it hits the lungs.
So, and that's why it's good to if possible, if you're jogging, breathe through your nose.
You're supposed to breathe through your nose, correct. And the other action that would be beneficial is to cover your mouth and nose with something like a scarf. And that does two things. One, it helps to moisturize the air that's being brought into the nose and mouth, because as you exhale, you're adding moisture. And so you've got a moisturized surface area there that helps the process before you take in that really cold, dry air.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about when it gets really dangerous. Well, frostbite, first of all. When frostbite happened, what's going on if we have that on a foot or a hand?
The simple way to look at it is that you are freezing water that is in the tissue. We have water in all of our tissues. That's a basic component of the body, and so we get crystals, water crystals, and so that tissue can then, when it freezes, be damaged with that freezing of the water and the subsequent tissue freezing. And so there's a spectrum of damage that can progress as you get exposed for a longer period of time. But as you mentioned, you're most susceptible fingers, toes, nose, ears, those exposed areas, and those areas that are at the end of the perfusion chain of the vasculature.
I remember as a kid being out too long sledding for hours and then coming home, being put in a hot bath, my mother sending me there, and then feeling like my skin, parts of my skin were just like crawling with ants. What was going on there? How close was I perhaps to frostbite?
You do see those kinds of reactions, and the recommendations now are not to go into really hot water, but to be exposed to warm air temperature or warm water baths, those kinds of things. What was probably happening in your circumstance was eventually a rapid dilation of the skin, so you were all of a sudden getting very warm blood flow from the central cavity to the periphery, and you would have that sensation of very warm blood going to that region, and certainly likely some type of damage to that tissue potentially.
Mm. How are different age groups affected differently by the cold? Who has to be most concerned?
The two ends of the spectrum in terms of age are typically the populations that we're most concerned about. Infants, in particular, they certainly don't have the behavioral abilities that you and I might in terms of, say, putting on warm clothes, pulling on a blanket. Also, they have a much greater surface area to mass ratio. So they have such a large surface area relative to their body weight, their body mass, that it's much easier for them to lose heat to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And aged populations are also very susceptible for a couple physiological reasons. One, they do not show that same robust vasoconstrictor response to the skin surface. So when they're exposed to cold weather, they don't have as strong of a constriction, so they don't shut down that blood flow of the skin as readily. And secondly, they typically have lower amounts of muscle mass. So their surface area to mass ratio tends to be a bit larger as well. And they don't have as much muscle mass to enhance their ability to shiver to help maintain body temperature.
Mm-hmm. Why do we shiver? Is that what is that?
Shivering is a reflex response to a decline, a small decline in our body core temperature. So a central sensor in the brain is going to note a rapid drop in temperature. We're going to turn on nerves that are going to contract muscles at a very high frequency. Muscles generate a lot of heat. And so it's a mechanism we have in the body to quickly generate heat to try to maintain or drive core body temperature back up.
Mm-hmm. So we've had a cold snap here. And of course, when it first got cold, let's say the first cold days in the fall, we felt cold. But if we would take that same fall day where we had the first coolness in the air and compare it with the way we feel when it actually warms up and is the same temperature in the spring, it'll feel just darn right warm, right? So
right.
We acclimatize to it. What's happening with our body there that the same temperature, same body, same person can feel so different?
There is a mixture of opinions in the literature in terms of how humans can acclimatize to the cold. Certainly we don't do it to nearly the same extent as we do to heat. Our bodies are magnificent at adjusting to heat and acclimatizing. Cold, not so much. A lot of it is just the ability to perceive and the sensation of cold and getting adjusted to that. You have to have pretty chronic exposure to cold to really create some of the physiological adjustments that would benefit you in terms of coping. There are studies showing individuals who are aerobically trained do tend to have a few beneficial adjustments. For example, they vasoconstrict their skin more quickly than an untrained person, and that may intuitively not necessarily make sense, but the design there would be to you'd have an advantage of reducing blood flow to the skin, so you'd have less heat dissipation, and you're having more blood flow go to centrally back to maintain cardiac output and enhance exercise performance.
Mm-hmm. Probably need to mention, if you find yourself in a tight situation, you're cold and you're worried about it and you're in any danger, alcohol, hard spirits may feel like they're burning on the way down when you drink them, may feel like they warm you up, but that's not the way to do things.
Correct. What happens with alcohol is that you do get that sensation of warmth. And the reason that's stimulated is because alcohol does cause opening of blood vessels to the skin. And so you do have warm blood flowing to skin regions. You've got thermoreceptors that sense that. And you notice when people drink alcohol, you can see flushed face, red cheeks, things like that. So they have the feeling of warmth, but all that warm blood is going to the skin and gets lost to the cold air environment. So
mm-hmm.
It's really counterproductive.
Kevin, are you pretty good in the cold weather? As a professor of human physiology who gets into the science of cold weather and how it affects the human body, are you okay with it?
Well, what I always tell students is that humans have two options in terms of dealing with the cold, and they're both behavioral. One is just put on more clothing, and the other is to seek shelter. And so I tend to try to follow my own advice to students in that regard.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. what if you're caught out in the cold? Quickly, in the minute before we go here, what do you need most to pay attention to if, I don't know, a stalled car in the ditch or something like that, no help immediately available? What do you need to pay most attention to?
The primary consideration is certainly to make sure you're covering exposed skin. And that would be these areas that we talked about that are vulnerable for frostbite, ears, nose if possible, certainly fingers and toes. So also, if you can start layering clothing, you don't want tight-fitting clothing, but you want multiple layers. And so those are the primary behavioral responses. And certainly, if you can stay active, as I mentioned, muscle contraction generates heat. So if you're stuck, if you can keep moving, that certainly is going to maintain some heat generation in the body until you can get some help.
So if you're stuck in the car, stay with the car,
yes.
and maybe sit in the seat and jostle around, try to do something that gets those muscles warm.
Right, and try to cover those exposed areas and get lots of layers on.
Okay, Kevin Craigle, fascinating work you have, expertise as professor of human physiology at the University of Iowa. Always enjoy talking with you, Kevin. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay, another reminder that on Monday, next week, our 2018 legislative session kicks off. So Monday, Joyce Russell will be joining me to co-host our first discussion on Legislative Mondays. We'll be talking with two lawmakers, each from each side of the aisle. Republican Representative Zach Nunn will be joining us. Also, Democratic Senator Pam Yoakum of Dubuque. We'll talk about a variety of issues, the opioid crisis, the budget woes, healthcare, education, taxes. I think Republicans have at the top of their agenda taxes. Hope you'll join us for our Legislative Edition kickoff on Monday. Okay, have a great weekend. We hope you stay bundled up, stay warm. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.